At Les Schwab Tires, when somebody needs their brakes checked, we check them for free. Because we figure, no matter how nice a set of tires we sell you might be, they're not worth much if they don't stop when you need them to. So if you come in to get some other stuff done, we'll check your brakes for free. And play it straight about what we found. Because, well, we figure, that's just the right thing to do. Les Schwab Tires. Doing the right thing matters.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Mark Susnell. You're listening to the Inspire Possibility Show. And every week I invite cutting-edge thought leaders who can inspire us to perhaps think in a new way, to consider possibilities that perhaps we really haven't considered before. And I know that one of the subjects that a lot of us don't really want to talk about until we have to, and especially when we're facing a serious illness ourselves, it might be terminal, or we have a loved one that is also facing such a diagnosis. And through some of the people that I know in Marin County, I was introduced to Dale Borglum, who was one of the founders of the Hahnemann Foundation in Santa Fe and the Living Dying Project. And I've talked to him briefly. I think you're going to find his wisdom enlightening. So without saying anything further, welcome Dale Borglum to the Inspire Possibility Show.
I'm sure glad to be here.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you're here too, on lots of levels.
So where else would I be?
Yes, exactly. What I always wonder is that we always teach what we want to learn, and so I'm just gonna start right there. Is what prompted you? What was going on in your life that you got involved with the Hahnemann Foundation and especially their dying project and the Living Dying Project, which I believe is in Fairfax. So what was going on in your life that inspired you, motivated you to kind of explore this mystery?
Well, it is a story, and it wasn't really that I was so fascinated with death. It's something that sort of more fell into my lap. I was a graduate student at Stanford in mathematics back in the late 60s and early 70s, getting a PhD there during the time of the consciousness explosion. And I had the good fortune to be a neighbor of a fellow named Joel, whose house Ram Dass would stay at whenever he came to Northern California. So I got to be drinking buddies with Ram Dass when I was in graduate school.
And even
before I'd met him, I was really interested in yoga and meditation. So meeting him was an added inspiration in that direction. After I got my PhD, I went off to India and did various things, but eventually ended up at the ashram of his guru, Neem Karoli Baba Maharaji, where I stayed for a while, and that really changed my life, meeting somebody who was the embodiment of love. Anyway, when I came back to America, you're going to say?
Yeah. Did Ram Dass, was he the one that inspired you to go to the ashram in India, where Neem Karoli Baba was there? Was that through?
He invited me to come to India with him, and I ended up somewhere else and was with another teacher for 6 months, and then eventually made my way, not so much to be with Ram Dass, but to be with his teacher. I knew other people also who had gone to study with Maharaji. So I ended up being there. Ram Dass was there. I spent about 7 months there at that point. And I came back to America and decided I didn't want to be a mathematician, that it didn't really fulfill me, that there was something that I could feel very intuitively that my heart was lacking and that being a mathematician wasn't going to be necessarily the answer to. I had gone to Berkeley and Stanford as an undergraduate and a graduate, and in my particular subspecialty, those two schools were the best two in the country, and yet my professors didn't seem to be particularly happy people. So I figured there's something else out there. And
right.
So I came back to America, and I was a chef for a while. I was the manager of a musical group, but eventually ended up becoming the executive director of Ram Dass's nonprofit Hanuman Foundation that you mentioned before, which was an umbrella nonprofit that supported service-oriented projects. One was called the Prison Ashram Project, where people went into prisons and worked with prisoners and told prisoners that being in prison is a lot like being in an ashram, except you don't choose to be there. You're fed and you have your cell to meditate, just like being in an ashram. But if you can change your resentment into motivation to open yourself up, being in prison doesn't have to be the horrible thing that it is for a lot of people. Anyway, at one point, Stephen Levine and Ram Dass taught a workshop in Rhode Island at which Elizabeth Kubler-Ross came as a student. This was in the late 60s at some point.
So,
Elizabeth
so
Kubler-Ross.
So she was a student of Ram Dass and Stephen Levine?
Well, she just came to this one workshop. I wouldn't say she was an ongoing student, but she was a workshop participant. Maybe that's a better noun to use there.
So,
and
as
probably you and most people know.
Let me just interrupt you for 1 second. Could you just briefly tell our listeners, in case some of them might not know who Ram Dass is, because I know you and I know, but just to let them know and a little bit who Stephen Levine is. And,
sure.
And so I have
I was just going to describe who Elizabeth is, but I'll give you a brief bio of all three of them. So Ram Dass used to be Richard Alpert. He and Timothy Leary and Ralph Metzner were the three people that started the psychedelic revolution on the East Coast. At the same time, Ken Kesey was doing this on the West Coast. They were at Harvard. They got in trouble for giving psychedelics to undergraduates at Harvard, got kicked out of Harvard, and continued Tim Leary's notion of tune in, turn on, tune in, drop out. And eventually Ram Dass at Richard Alpert at that point ended up going to India, realizing that psychedelics weren't the final answer, that he would take these drugs and he would have these amazing insights, but then he'd come back and get pretty firmly embedded in his personality again. So he went to India and met Maharaji and came back and now had the name Ram Dass. And this was in the late 60s, early 70s, and he really had a very brilliant ability to explain esoteric Eastern practices in very understandable and psychologically astute ways to a lay audience. This was just at the time when yoga and meditation was beginning to become popular, and he was the foremost Western explainer of Eastern practices. So that's who Ram Dass was. Stephen Levine was a poet and a publisher. He published the Oracle psychedelic newspaper in the Haight during the 60s. He knew Ram Dass, and then Stephen got very deeply involved in mindfulness, Vipassana meditation. So when Ram Dass was having these workshops, sometimes he'd invite Stephen to come along and be the meditation teacher. So this was like maybe 68 or something like that, and Ram Dass and Stephen were teaching a workshop in Rhode Island. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who was a physician from Chicago, was the first person in the West to really bring death out of the closet and to be able to have intelligent conversations in public about dying. Up until then, dying was really denied and avoided and kind of pushed under the carpet, if you will. So she came as a participant to this workshop. She really hit it off with Stephen and invited him to be the meditation teacher at her dying retreats. She was going around the country teaching these workshops about death and dying. She wrote a very famous book called On Death and Dying.
Uh-huh.
So they worked together for a while, and her work kind of veered off in another direction with more violent psychodrama, which didn't really dovetail too well with Stephen's Buddhist meditation. So they amicably parted ways, and Ramdas invited Stephen to do what he was doing as part of the Hanuman Foundation. And he did, and Stephen then invited me to be the Buddhist meditation teacher at his retreats. And it's really impossible to be at a retreat where people are dying and people are grieving and just be the Buddhist meditation teacher, that one gets in a very heartfelt way pulled into all the human stories, of course, that are happening. So that was really how I got involved with this. It wasn't that I thought, oh, this would be a fantastic thing to do, but as the director of Ram Dass's foundation, it just seemed like by far the most interesting thing that was going on in our nonprofit. And I really loved working with Stephen. He was just a brilliant, heartfelt, wide-open human being. You may know that he died about a year and a half ago.
Right.
So
that's origin.
Kind of the history of it. And so we did a bunch of teaching together for a while, the three of us, and eventually decided it would be a great idea to actually have a place where people could come and die consciously. So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross had been talking about dying. We took it another level to talk about conscious dying. In other words, applying basic spiritual concepts to the encounter with life-threatening illness. And at that point, death was still one of the areas in our society where consciousness was least able to penetrate. Fear of death is so pervasive and often so unexamined. So we started talking about meditation and compassion and awareness in relationship to caregiving and in relationship to dying and grieving. The three of us decided to move to Santa Fe, New Mexico in the early 1980s and started a facility called the Dying Center, which I became the director of. And for 3 years, about 85 people came to this facility to die consciously or along with sometimes their partner. And that was the first residential facility in the West for people to die consciously.
On the website of the Hanuman Foundation that a lot of these people that came to that center got better.
They did actually. I mean, they came to a place that was free of charge, and we had a very loving staff. So for the first 6 months or so, everybody that came got better and left. And I was in the kind of ironic situation of waiting for somebody to die in order to validate my career.
Right.
So, and eventually, of course, a number of our clients died. So we use this as sort of a model for what can be done in hospitals, what can be done in your home, what can be done in hospices, of bringing the dimension of spirituality into contact with dying and caregiving for dying.
Mm-hmm. And then this evolved. How did this go from the Dying Project in Santa Fe, the Hanuman Foundation, to the Living Dying Project that you're involved in now in Fairfax?
I ran that for 3.5 years, and eventually I decided to move back to California. Basically, it was a very intensive situation. If you can imagine living in a house and the person in the next bedroom was dying and they would die, and then somebody else would move into the bedroom and they would die. So all the people that worked there said it was the most rewarding yet most challenging thing they'd ever done in their lives. And for 3.5 years, I was caregiving, fundraising, doing the whole thing. I really didn't have any time for personal life. And so after 3.5 years, a friend of mine who owned the house we were doing this in outside of Santa Fe, decided that he needed to move into the house himself, and myself and the other people on the staff thought this would be a good time to do the next thing in our lives. And I moved back here to California, started the Living Dying Project, not as part of the Hanuman Foundation anymore, and moved back here fortuitously right before my father started dying. So I was able to be here and support him in that back in 1986, 1987.
So what would you say are the biggest insights that you've learned that would help other people with facing death or themselves or loved ones facing death? What was your biggest gifts from that would be a benefit to other people?
Well, one of my spiritual teachers said that until one comes into intimate contact with death, your spiritual practice will have the quality of you being a dilettante. So that it's not quite a direct answer to your question, but I really encourage people, if you ever have a chance to do this work, if you can be with a loved one who is approaching death, it is a great inspiration. It can be an incredibly heart-opening experience to be with someone who's dying. And some of the things I've learned are that, first of all, there are very few special techniques or ideas that one needs to bring to the bedside of someone who's dying. The very same qualities that allow me to be with you and the other listeners or people in my life, qualities like compassion and generosity and openness, are the same qualities that help you support someone who's dying or to be someone who's dying. There are a few practices that I teach our volunteers here at the Living Dying Project that can be done in the last few days of someone's life. But basically, qualities of awareness, compassion, embodiment, empowerment, things that contemplative spiritual traditions talk about are exactly what's needed to be with someone who's dying. The other thing that I've learned is that almost everybody, the first time they come to the possibility of being with someone who's dying, says, I'm not sure I can do this. I had a friend who was a 20-year meditator and a 25-year Berkeley psychotherapist. She was a volunteer in our agency, and I called her up and said, we finally have a client for you. Your first client, she says, I'm not ready to do it. And I said, look, you've been meditating all these years. You've been a therapist all these years. You've got to do it. You're the only person available. So that very often people get very wrapped up in identities. Like right now, if Donald Trump walked in the room,
right,
it would be hard to see a human being. You'd see the identity of good president or bad president or whatever whatever identities you happen to project on him. And the identity of being a dying person is one of the strongest identities in our culture, that when somebody's dying, that you see there is a cancer patient or there is a dying person rather than there's a human being who happens to be a body that might be dying soon. So in terms of practices and ways of supporting, let me plug our website, livingdying.org, which is the most complete site as far as I've ever seen on the Internet, with many free available practices for caregivers, for dying people, guided meditations, lectures by me, Stephen Levine, Roshi Joan Halifax, different people. And I encourage people to go there and just check out what we have if you're interested in this topic at all.
So again, that's livingdying.org is the website?
Yeah, livingdying.org.
So in basically the Living Dying Project is a nonprofit?
Yeah, it's a nonprofit here in California. I train people in the community to offer one-to-one free of charge, quote, emotional spiritual support, unquote, to people with life-threatening illnesses in Marin, Sonoma, San Francisco, Alameda, and Contra Costa counties. And as well, we have ongoing training programs. I have ongoing groups in San Francisco, in Marin, and in Santa Rosa, small groups. And the volunteers that work with our clients come to ongoing support groups.
And do you have anything ongoing right now or in the next month or so, any workshops planned that are going to be in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area?
Yeah, I do come to think of it. I should have mentioned that. Next Saturday on June 9th from 10 to 5 o'clock, I'm teaching a workshop on conscious dying at California Institute of Integral Studies, CIIS, which you can go to our website that I just mentioned, and there's some information about that under events, or CIIS has their own website that you could find all the information on that upcoming workshop.
Right. So when you were talking about the identity that people have with death in our culture, how does that compare to, say, Eastern culture?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know quite how to answer it. I mean, things in the East are really changing. I lived in the East. I traveled in Tibet and India and China and different places. And these societies are becoming much more westernized. Everybody's got a cell phone and everybody's got a TV set. So it's not like the East was back when some of these contemplative traditions really came into being. And in fact, the Dalai Lama on his third visit to America said, "Now I'm beginning to understand, and it makes me very sad, you Americans don't like yourselves." So all of these Eastern practices were developed by and for people 1,500 to 2,500, 3,000 years ago, who were grounded, centered, walking around barefoot, loved their mother and father, and were ready to start this great project of disidentifying with ego structure and identifying with true nature or Buddha nature, Christ consciousness, whatever name you'd like to use. So that it doesn't take too much imagination to see that if one begins trying to disidentify with ego structure, but your ego is really neurotic and you're ungrounded and you're walking around with a telephone slapped to your ear all day long, then not too far down the road, it's going to get kind of complicated and messy. So one of the things I do when I'm training people or in these groups is really encourage starting very much at the beginning, that Vipassana meditation and Zen practices and devotional practices are incredibly wonderful things. But if you don't have a foundation of being embodied and trusting that it's safe to be here in some fundamental sense, then it's very easy to get lost on the sidetrack in these practices or kind of run into a dead end and have your practice start feeling pretty stagnant.
When you say safe to be there, what are you referring to?
Yeah. What I'm saying is that in the first 2 years of a child's life, her or his task is learning to trust that she can be dependent, that it's okay to be grounded, that you don't have to be hyper alert, that your mother's not going to drop you on the floor, the earth isn't going to open up and swallow you. But to the extent that you or I have had trauma in the first couple of years of our life, and we all have. I had very loving parents, but certain things happened to me that I don't really need to get into right now. We don't have much time left. But in spite of all their loving parenting, I got an electrical shock. At one time, I wasn't fed for a long time through kind of a complication. And so I got this message that the world isn't a safe place. Now, by safe, I understand that I might die today, you might die today, I might die tomorrow, I might get sick, I might break my leg, any of those things. But fundamentally, is it safe for me to trust just being here? Ramdas wrote a book, Be Here Now. Can we trust being here now, or do we have to be hyper alert, conceptualizing what's going on, trying to fix and manipulate? Or, as Buddhism suggests, that there is a whole unwounded core in all of us, that no matter what kind of personality we have, underneath the veil of that personality is Buddha nature. There's something that is safe to trust. There's something that's safe to surrender into, and that just by being aware of what's happening rather than getting lost and manipulating and fixing in the big self-improvement project all the time, just by being aware, we're moving more fully into that place of wholeness.
So one question I always like to ask all my guests is, since this is the Inspire Possibility Show, what inspires you right now?
What inspires me? Well, I have been doing this work since, as I said, since 40 years, I guess. Is that what it is? 68? Yeah, 40 years. And what actually inspires me most right now is not working. It's playing. Being willing to just walk on Mount Tamalpais and water the garden. I've got two friends who have advanced cancer, who have both been given very dire prognoses. And I have another friend on the East Coast who is in so much pain from a broken neck that she's had for a few decades now from an automobile accident, that she's considering ending her life. And then I have clients who aren't even friends so much, but so that there's a lot of suffering in my life. And that inspires me, but it's so easy to get caught up in, I've got to stay busy to fix everybody. And what I realize more and more is that by slowing down and trusting that my heart is a compassionate heart and taking space to nourish myself, that then I do take these extra moments to do practice for the people I know who are suffering, to do compassion practice or prayer practice for people. And so I guess what inspires me is some combination of having compassion for myself that allows me to be energetic and alive enough to really have compassion for all the people I know who are having a hard time. And we look around, there's so much suffering in the world. It's a strange time in the history of this planet, as I'm sure almost everybody who's paying attention here is aware of. And I've got a younger son, and I know a lot of younger people, and I really have a lot of faith in this younger generation. That's certainly something that inspires me. I think there are a lot of teenagers right now who are way, way, way more grown up and mature and committed than I was when I was a teenager back in the day. So I guess those are the things that inspire me, that the younger generation, the suffering of people that I know, and my own need to take care of myself and play and not get weighted down by the suffering that is prevalent.
Final question. What are you most grateful for?
Boy, it's hard to say what I'm most grateful for. I'm certainly most grateful for meeting my teacher, who is the complete embodiment of love. And secondarily, I'm grateful for my son, who's my best friend in some way. And I'm grateful for having a mind and a body that's allowed me to keep doing this work almost nonstop for the last 40 years and having passion to continue.
Wow. Thank you so much, Dale Borglum, for being our guest on the Inspire Possibility Show. You are an inspiration, a role model, a visionary, and somebody who is incredibly committed to yourself and other people, and making, giving people comfort and your compassion. It's just it's thankful that there are people like you in the world that that can comfort people during these most precious moments. So thanks again to Dale Borglum. He's our guest today on the Inspire Possibilities Show. And each week we have other people that hopefully will inspire us in many ways. And in the meantime, until next week, journey on.
At Les Schwab Tires, when somebody needs their brakes checked, we check them for free. Because we figure, no matter how nice a set of tires we sell you might be, they're not worth much if they don't stop when you need them to. So if you come in to get some other stuff done, we'll check your brakes for free. And play it straight about what we found. Because, well, we figure, that's just the right thing to do. Les Schwab Tires. Doing the right thing matters. At Les Schwab Tires, when somebody needs their brakes checked, we check them for free. Because we figure, no matter how nice a set of tires we sell you might be, they're not worth much if they don't stop when you need them to. So if you come in to get some other stuff done, we'll check your brakes for free. And play it straight about what we found. Because, well, we figure, that's just the right thing to do. Les Schwab Tires. Doing the right thing matters.